From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
By commuting Scooter Libby's sentence, George Bush has basically protected himself and Vice President Cheney from potential criminal implication in the CIA leak case.
President Bush commutes the sentence of Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, sparing him from a 2.5-year prison sentence. Bush's move came hours after a federal appeals panel ruled Libby could not delay his prison term. This as President Bush holds meetings with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
One thing I found about Vladimir Putin is that he is consistent, transparent, honest, and is an easy man to discuss, our opportunities and problems with.
The two leaders stayed with Bush's father at the family compound in Kennebunkport, Maine, topping the agenda, White House plans for a missile defense system in Central Europe. We'll get the latest. And we'll speak with two high school students who personally handed President Bush a letter calling on the U.S. to stop torturing prisoners. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has commuted the sentence of Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, sparing him from a 2.5-year prison sentence in the CIA leak case. The move came just 5 hours after a federal appeals panel had made Libby's imprisonment imminent, ruling he could not put off his sentence while appealing his conviction. Libby was convicted in March, the highest-ranking White House official ordered to prison since the Iran-Contra affair. He was found guilty of perjury, obstruction of justice, and making false statements in the investigation into who blew the cover of CIA officer Valerie Plame, whose husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, had criticized the Iraq War. In a statement, President Bush said, quote, "I respect the jury's verdict, but I've concluded the prison sentence given to Mr. Libby is excessive." Libby's prosecutor, special counsel Patrick Fitzgerald, disputed Bush's view, saying, quote, "an experienced federal judge imposed a sentence consistent with the applicable laws." Democrats condemned the decision. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid called Libby's conviction, quote, "the one faint glimmer of accountability for White House efforts to manipulate intelligence." Libby won't see a day of jail time. His felony conviction will remain, and he will have to pay a $250,000 fine and serve 2 years probation. We'll have more on the story after headlines. In Iraq, at least 10 civilians have been killed in a U.S. airstrike on the city of Diwaniyah. The Pentagon says it was targeting insurgent gunfire. Iraqi police shot and killed one person while dispersing a crowd of angry residents who had taken to the streets in protest. In other Iraq news, a Pentagon spokesperson has accused Iran of organizing and backing Hezbollah fighters to attack U.S. troops. Brigadier General Kevin Bergner said the fighters were used in a January attack that killed 5 U.S. soldiers. A spokesperson for Iran's foreign ministry dismissed the charge as, quote, "silly, ridiculous, and a sheer lie." 4 female employees of the contractor Kellogg Brown & Root said its former corporate parent, Halliburton, have filed suit alleging sexual harassment and 2 cases of rape while working in Iraq. In separate filings, the women say they faced repeated sexual harassment despite complaining to their supervisors. One plaintiff says she needed surgery after being drugged and raped by male co-workers in Baghdad in 2005. KBR is the largest military contractor in Iraq. Here in the United States, 3 members of Iraq Veterans Against the War were arrested this weekend after they tried to meet with active duty soldiers at the base at Fort Benning, Georgia. According to the group, Liam Madden and Nathan Lewis were arrested after being told they could not wear political T-shirts. The two were wearing shirts reading Iraq Veterans Against the War. Fellow veteran Adam Kokesh was then arrested despite changing into a plain shirt. The veterans have been ordered to appear in court later this month to face trespassing charges. The arrest came just days after the 3 were detained in a similar incident at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. In campaign news, Senator Barack Obama has emerged as the leading fundraiser for the second quarter of the year. Obama pulled in $32.5 million in donations, almost all for the primary race. Most of the money came from small donations averaging $200, meaning those same donors can contribute again. Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton came in second at $27 million. Former North Carolina Senator John Edwards was third at $9 million. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, Arizona Senator John McCain has let go dozens of campaign staffers after falling far short of his fundraising goals. McCain's campaign is struggling with a budget of around $2 million. In Israel and the occupied territories, Palestinian officials in the Fatah-controlled West Bank are demanding Israel release the full amount of Palestinian tax revenue it's frozen for more than a year. Israel promised to hand over the funds after Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas dismissed the democratically elected Hamas-led government last month. But Palestinians say Israel's transferred just one-fifth of the more than $600 million owed. This is Chief Palestinian Negotiator Saab Erekat.
I need to remind you here that this money is Palestinian money. It's not an Israeli money. These are Palestinian revenues. We, as I said, we're under occupation. We don't have airports. We don't have harbors. So all our imports come through Israeli ports and Israeli harbors and airports. In accordance with the Paris Protocol, Israel collects these revenues for us, deduct a surcharge of 3%, and then transfer the rest, which is equivalent between $55 to $60 million a month. Today, I believe we have more than $600 million. Israel had transferred 20% of it. And we need to transfer the whole lot.
The Israeli nuclear whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu has been sentenced to another 6 months in prison for speaking to the international media. Vanunu was released in 2004 after spending 18 years in jail for disclosing information about Israel's stockpile of nuclear weapons. Israel then barred Vanunu from speaking to the foreign press, but he defied the order, speaking to several foreign outlets, including Democracy Now! Earlier this year, an Israeli court convicted him of violating the terms of his release. On Monday, Vanunu attorney Avigdor Feldman denounced the new sentence.
Vanunu was convicted for violating a rule that does not exist in any other democratic world that forbids speaking to foreigners, regardless of the contents of the conversation. The court convicted him, sentenced him to 6 months in prison. This sentence is not acceptable and not imaginable.
In addition to his foreign media ban, Vanunu is also barred from leaving Israel. Speaking to reporters outside the courtroom, Vanunu urged Israel to let him leave.
My target is to be free to leave this country. I don't want to live here. They have 18 years in prison, and now another 3 years. I want to leave and to start my life. I have the right to be free. I'm a free man. I want to be free, and I want to leave. I'm not answering any question now.
At least eight people are now in custody in connection with the attempted car bombings in London and Glasgow last week. Five of the suspects are said to either work as doctors or study in medical school. One of the suspects, Jordanian neurosurgeon Mohammed Asha, was arrested along with his wife in Newcastle. On Monday, Asha's father, Abdul Qadir Asha, declared his son's innocence and called for his release.
I'm sure Mohammed does not have any links of this nature because of his history in Jordan. And since he was born, he has not undertaken any kind of activity of this nature.
Opposition activists in Mexico are marking the one-year anniversary of a controversial election that brought the country to a standstill. President Felipe Calderón defeated former Mexico City Mayor Andrés Manuel López Obrador by just over half a percentage point. But Calderón's victory was marred by accusations of corruption and fraud. On Sunday, López Obrador joined with tens of thousands of supporters at a major rally in Mexico City.
One year from the election fraud, we are able to say with pride and decision that the right and its supporters were wrong.
Aquí estamos.
Here we are, continuing, convinced more than ever of the need of pushing for an alternative project for the nation.
In Argentina, the wife of President Néstor Kirchner has announced she'll run as a candidate in Argentina's presidential election later this year. Cristina Fernández de Kirchner will run in place of her husband, who's not seeking a second term. In an interview last week, Nelson Kirchner said he is willing to become Argentina's first gentleman.
Whether someone is president or first lady or first gentleman, as some say, what does it matter? What matters is that Argentina goes ahead in its process of change. We have to push ourselves forward. Both women and men have to continue transforming Argentina.
Néstor Kirchner, the president of Argentina. In India, hundreds of people gathered in the southern city of Chennai to protest the visit of a U.S. aircraft carrier. The nuclear-powered USS Nimitz is the first U.S. aircraft carrier to visit India's ports. This is David Pandian of the Communist Party of India.
We are totally opposed to the visit of this warship because it is a violation of our foreign policy. India had been, from the inception of its independence, had been following a neutral policy that had been aiming for world peace. But now, the Manmohan Singh-led government has descended down to the low level of abdicating all that we had stood for.
Venezuela and Iran have increased ties with a series of new deals. On Monday, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and the Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad announced agreements on a joint petrochemical plant and other economic cooperation. Speaking in Tehran, Chavez said the two countries are forming a brotherly front against the Bush administration.
And I finish with this. As I am here, they begin to worry when they see us together. Seeing two hands joined together for the good of our nations.
In other news from Iran, Iran's state broadcaster has launched its first 24-hour English news channel. Press TV director Shahab Mosavat said he hopes to compete with the satellite networks, including Al Jazeera and the BBC.
Press TV is a 24-hour English language news network set up here in Iran. We broadcast from Tehran and around the world. Our aims are to provide, be a news provider globally. What we do in terms of output, we have programs that are both global and cover the Middle East.
And finally, in Turkey, 18 suspects went on trial Monday for the murder of Turkish-Armenian editor Hrant Dink. Dink was slain outside his office in January in what many believe was a political killing for his efforts to challenge Turkish denial of the Armenian genocide. More than 1,000 people demonstrated outside the courtroom Monday demanding a fair proceeding. Several Turkish newspapers have reported one of the main suspects said he murdered Dink on the orders of police officers. The lead-up to the trial has brought accusations of lackluster investigations and state interference. This is Dink's lawyer, Fethiye Çetin.
Of course, our suspicions continue because it is a general problem here. What happened during the Semdinli investigation is a clear sign of it. Firstly, all control over the legal system must be removed. This is the biggest problem.
Çetin was referring to the recent overturning of a 40-year jail term for two paramilitary officers over their role in a controversial bombing of a bookstore in the eastern town of Semdinli 2 years ago. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has commuted the sentence of Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, sparing him from a 2.5-year prison sentence in the CIA leak case. Bush's move came just 5 hours after a federal appeals panel ruled Libby could not put off serving a sentence while he appealed his conviction. That meant jail time for Libby was imminent. The U.S. Bureau of Prisons had already assigned him a federal prisoner number. Libby was convicted in March, the highest-ranking White House official ordered to prison since the Iran-Contra scandal. He was found guilty of perjury, obstruction of justice, and making false statements in the investigation into who blew the cover of CIA officer Valerie Plame, whose husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, had criticized the Iraq War. In a statement on Monday, Bush said, quote, "I respect the jury's verdict, but I have concluded the prison sentence given to Mr. Libby is excessive." Bush didn't give Libby a full pardon. The felony conviction will remain, and Libby will still have to pay a $250,000 fine and serve 2 years of probation, but he won't see a day of jail time. The president's announcement came at the start of the Independence Day holiday week with Congress in recess. Democrats swiftly condemned Bush's decision. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada called it disgraceful. Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Patrick Leahy of Vermont said it was, quote, emblematic of a White House that sees itself as being above the law. The Washington Post reports Bush has granted far fewer pardons and commutations than any of his predecessors, dating back to John F. Kennedy. He commuted three previous prison terms during his 6.5 years in office. Marcy Wheeler has been closely following this story. She's the author of Anatomy of Deceit, How the Bush Administration Used the Media to Sell the Iraq War and Out a Spy. She writes for the political blog, The Next Hurrah. She joins us from the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Marcy.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Your response to the commutation of Scooter Libby's sentence, he won't serve a day in jail.
It's not surprising in the least. George Bush and Dick Cheney couldn't afford the risk that Libby would flip on them rather than go do jail time. But it is pretty disgusting, I think.
Explain that. What do you mean they couldn't afford him to flip on them?
Well, the whole point of the obstruction of justice was that Libby was refusing to answer certain questions that really pointed right towards, especially Dick Cheney, but even George Bush himself. The best example is that after reading Joe Wilson's op-ed, Vice President Cheney ordered Scooter Libby to leak something to Judy Miller. And then following that, Scooter Libby proceeded to leak Valerie Plame's identity and the contents of the CIA report on Joe Wilson's trip. Now, Scooter Libby says that he was ordered to leak the NIE, the National Intelligence Estimate, but that doesn't make any sense given the rest of his story. So it seems logical and probable that Dick Cheney, in fact, ordered Scooter Libby to leak Valerie Plame's identity. But by lying, Scooter Libby has protected the vice president from any kind of criminal implication from his actions.
And how does President Bush wiping out his jail time protect Bush and Cheney?
Well, in some ways, the commutation is actually worse than a pardon, because with the commutation, Scooter Libby still retains his Fifth Amendment privileges. So if John Conyers tomorrow called up Scooter Libby and said, "We got to talk. I'd like to know exactly what happened when Dick Cheney ordered you to leak something classified to Judy Miller. I want to know whether President Bush actually did declassify it or whether Vice President Cheney was just making that up." He does that, and Scooter Libby just says, "I plead the Fifth," and we as American citizens don't get to understand what our president and what our vice president did to retaliate against somebody who was just exercising his First Amendment speech rights.
Does it also mean if Scooter Libby didn't want to go to jail but was facing that jail time, there was the possibility he would speak, and this wipes that out?
Yeah, I mean, I went to see Scooter Libby's actual sentencing, and through the entire trial, he kind of maintained a calm. But when the sentence was actually read out, he looked like a ghost. He looked like he had never actually believed that he was going to have to do jail time. And at that moment, you know, for a split second, you believed that this very loyal man perhaps might actually go and start telling the truth about what Vice President Cheney and President Bush had done with respect to the leak case.
Does it also mean, I mean, the president has continually said, the vice president, that they will not comment as this case goes through the legal system, that actually it's still alive because there hasn't been a final pardon. So it means they can continue to say they won't comment.
Oh, I think that the press is going to be asking a lot of questions today about why it is. I mean, here's another thing that's scandalous about this, Amy. The Bush administration is pushing Congress to require minimum sentences. What they're trying to do is they're trying to change the law such that the minimum sentencing requirements are mandatory. So they're saying that you and I, if we're found guilty of something, are required to fulfill that minimum sentence. Scooter Libby's minimum sentence, according to the guidelines, was 30 months. And George Bush says no, he doesn't have to do what you and I would have to do in the same circumstances. So it seems like, I mean, this just raises the bar, and I hope that the press continues to ask questions about this, and I hope that they refuse to let Bush get away with not answering these questions, because the point is that Bush and Cheney really are deeply implicated. There are plenty of indications that they knew Valerie Plame was covert, that they did this deliberately, and the one thing that has protected them so far has been Scooter Libby's silence.
How is Bush implicated directly, Marcy Wheeler?
Well, it's actually interesting. What started off, what kicked off the campaign into high gear against the Wilsons was on, if you remember, on June 8th, 2003, Condi Rice went on George Stephanopoulos' show, and she got beat up because she claimed that nobody knew the Niger intelligence was false. The next morning, first thing in Scooter Libby's notes for the day was a note saying that Bush was concerned about these allegations, about the Christoph article. And after that, after Bush getting involved, is when the vice president's office started doing all of this research into Joe Wilson's trip, into Valerie Wilson, and so on and so forth. And then come October, when Vice President Cheney was trying to get Bush to exonerate Scooter Libby, he actually wrote a note that basically said the president, and then he crossed out the president because he didn't want to implicate him, but he was about to write, the president asked Scooter Libby to put his neck in the meat grinder, basically to respond to Joe Wilson. So from start to finish, at least according to Vice President Cheney, George Bush has been centrally involved in this. Plus, I mean, according to Libby, according to Cheney, George Bush is the one who declassified whatever it was that Scooter Libby leaked to Judy Miller. Did George Bush declassify Valerie Plame's identity? That's a question we have a right to know, and that's a question that Scooter Libby's lies have prevented us from learning the answer to.
Marcy Wheeler, Scooter Libby still has to pay a $250,000 fine. Can you talk about who actually will be paying that? Can you talk about his defense fund, who's running it, where the money is coming from?
Yeah, I mean, Scooter Libby has a defense fund that includes people like presidential candidate Fred Thompson, who used to be a law and order guy, but now thinks that, you know, it's okay to lie. It's people like James Woolsey, who was very deeply implicated in introducing INC defectors and basically making the fraudulent case to bring us into war.
James Woolsey, the former CIA director, the INC, of course, the Iraq National Congress, Ahmed Chalabi's group that was pushing for war.
Yeah, so this is a person who's deeply implicated in contributing to this false case for war. Well, he's dumping money and he's making the case that Scooter Libby should do no jail time. There's Mary Madeline. Mary Madeline was involved in the response to Wilson the week of the leak, and she's the one running this entire show, this entire defense fund. So it's all these people who are very, very deeply implicated, if not in the actual leak itself, although there are quite a few who are implicated in the leak and in passing on classified information, but also very deeply implicated in the case for war. And these people are raising money so that Scooter Libby doesn't have to pay any personal price for having lied to federal prosecutors.
President Bush can still pardon him as well, is that right?
Oh, sure. I think the biggest reason why Bush didn't pardon Libby already is because once Libby's pardoned, then he loses his Fifth Amendment rights. So if he does pardon Libby, then again, John Conyers is going to call him into Congress and say, tell us the truth about what Cheney and Bush actually did.
Dana Perino, the White House press secretary, said less than a month ago, given the fact that the judge has set up a process for appeal, and given the way the president has handled this for the past year or so, he's not going to intervene.
That didn't last very long, did it? Like I said, I think they were really worried that if Libby actually had to go to jail. I also think they suspected one of the judges who yesterday basically said Scooter's appeal had not enough merit to justify giving him bond pending appeal was Judge Santel, who was a Reagan appointee. He got involved in Iran-Contra and in the past has always done precisely what the Republican Party has needed to do to get people off on crimes. And even Judge Santel found that Scooter Libby's case, his conviction seemed merited, and that Scooter Libby's claims to have a reason to appeal the case didn't have much to them.
The other development this week was the UN disbanding its weapons inspection team, UNMVIC, the UN Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission, that has finally concluded there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Can you end by talking about the significance of what Scooter Libby did, and you're saying his connection to Vice President Cheney and President Bush? Why this is so central to what we're seeing now in Iraq, to the war in Iraq?
Well, we're at the point now where it's crystal clear the case that was made to bring us into war was completely fraudulent. And at the time when a private citizen started making that case publicly to the American people, the Bush administration's first response was to lash out, to break the law, to put the United States at further security risk. I mean, Valerie Wilson was out there on the front lines trying to prevent the proliferation of WMD. And Vice President Cheney decided to piss away that entire career just so that he could fight back against Joe Wilson's claims that, in fact, the 16 words, the claim that Iraq was looking for uranium in Niger was bunk. So, you know, where are the priorities of this administration? They're going to bring us into war on the claim that it's protecting us from WMD and then ruin the career of a CIA officer who was doing precisely that. She was putting her life on the line to make sure that we were kept safe from exactly that, the proliferation of WMD.
It's very interesting that President Bush issued this commutation from Kennebunkport, Maine, with his dad there, President George H.W. Bush, who, well, it was with his involvement that the law was written that CIA agents should not be outed, and if they are, it's a crime.
Right, but then, of course, Bush's father also has a history of pardoning somebody to prevent any kind of implication in his own acts of potential criminal violation, in that case, the Iran-Contra.
And can you be specific about the people that he pardoned?
Oh, sure. George Bush Sr. pardoned Cap Weinberger just as the investigation in Iran-Contra was getting close to his own actions. It was pretty clear he was involved in that, and so he did the same thing that Bush just did. Pardon the guy who can implicate you, and then everything's gone. Everything. I mean, it's as if these people think that they operate above the law, and they are not subject to the same laws that you or I are subject to.
Marcy Wheeler, thanks very much for joining us, author of Anatomy of Deceit, How the Bush Administration Used the Media to Sell the Iraq War and Out a Spy. She writes the political blog The Next Hurrah under the name Empty Wheel. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we talk about what's happening at Kennebunkport, the meeting between President Putin and the Bushes. Stay with us. Little Lies, Fleetwood Mac here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush met with Russian President Vladimir Putin at the Bush family compound in Kennebunkport, Maine, yesterday. The 24-hour visit was intended to cool heightening tensions in U.S.-Russian relations. Topping the agenda, White House plans to build a missile defense system in Central Europe, Iran's nuclear program, independence for Kosovo, and contrasting views on democracy. After a morning fishing trip with Bush's father, the two presidents emerged to address reporters.
through the course of our relationship, there have been times when we've agreed on issues, and there's been times when we haven't agreed on issues.
В течение наших взаимоотношений были вопросы, по которым у нас было согласие, и вопросы, по которым не было.
One thing I found about Vladimir Putin is that he is consistent, transparent, honest, and is an easy man to discuss, you know, our opportunities and problems with.
President Putin, the only world leader invited by Bush to stay with him at the main oceanfront estate, said the two leaders are seeking to resolve their differences. He thanked Bush for his hospitality.
And I was pleased to know that we are seeking the points of coincidence in our positions, and very frequently we do find them.
Я, конечно, очень благодарен семье Джорджа за ту очень теплую атмосферу, которая была создана для нашей встречи и для обмена мнениями.
And I'm very grateful to the Bush family for this very warm, homely atmosphere around this meeting, and we appreciate it very much.
Putin repeated his earlier suggestion the United States use a Soviet-era early warning radar system in Azerbaijan as a substitute for the radar and interceptors the White House wants to place in Poland and the Czech Republic. Russia has strongly opposed U.S. plans to base parts of the proposed missile defense shield near Russia's borders and recently warned it might target its missiles towards Europe in retaliation. On Iran, Bush said he and Putin share concerns about Iran's nuclear program. However, the two leaders don't see eye to eye on sanctions or even whether Iranian missiles currently pose a threat. As Putin arrived in Kennebunkport Sunday, more than 1,500 people demonstrated nearby against the war in Iraq and ongoing Russian policy in Chechnya. Katrina Vandenhoevel is the editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, longtime analyst on U.S.-Russian relations, joining us in our Firehouse studio. Joining us from Boston is Theodore Postol, a professor of science, technology, and national security policy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, former scientific and policy advisor to the Pentagon on nuclear weapons and related matters, including missile defense. Katrina Vandenhoevel, let's start with you, the significance of this trip.
Well, they're calling it the Lobster Summit because of the nice atmospherics. I would call it the PR Summit. You know, they had nice personal atmospherics, but nothing came out of this in terms of any agreement that is going to really improve U.S.-Russian relations or benefit the world, because fundamentally it's not about the personal relationship between Putin and Bush, though the Wall Street Journal must be having hysterics about Bush's description of Putin as transparent and trustworthy and honest. They just accused him of killing people the other week. But fundamentally, the two countries are at loggerheads over fundamental issues. You ticked off a few at the top: NATO expansion, missile defense, Iran, the question of sanctions, Kosovo and independence. And all of this, Amy, predates Putin in many ways, because NATO expansion, which even someone like New York Times columnist Tom Friedman, who was a booster, now recognizes has created this atmosphere of a kind of Cold War. We are paying the price for that and other policies of the United States.
Theodore Postol, your response to what the Bush administration is proposing. Explain this so-called missile defense.
Well, the missile defense that they're talking about, that the Bush administration has proposed, is going to have a radar in the Czech Republic and missile interceptors in northern Poland. Now, the administration has stated that this system could not engage Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles if they were fired toward the United States. And that does not appear to be true if one accepts the capabilities of the system as described by the Missile Defense Agency. We've done an analysis that shows that this is not a true statement. And in fact, we've also looked a little bit at the at variants of the Putin proposal, and we find that placing radars much closer to the launch sites, that is to say, to the postulated Iranian missile threat in Azerbaijan or in Turkey, would in fact do a much better job of actually achieving the defensive capability that the Bush administration states it wants to achieve.
Katrina Vandenhoevel.
You know, I mean, what's going on here, Amy, is the Bush administration wants to deploy a technology that does not work against a threat that does not exist. And this is against the backdrop, most fundamentally, of the dismantling of an arms control and disarmament regime that the U.S. and Russia have constructed over the last 25, 30 years. You know, global warming is a fundamental issue, but it is very hard to do a lot right now. Something we can do a lot about is 20 years after the end of the Cold War, we can really begin to build down. Instead, the Bush administration withdrew the United States from the ABM treaty, has basically enacted a false arms control treaty, which would allow both countries to keep missiles in reserve. 6,000 long-range missiles are still on hair trigger alert. This is folly. And the other interesting thing, which Professor Postol didn't mention, is with all the talk of democracy promotion in this country, what is overlooked is the fact that mayors in the Czech Republic, where the radar sites will be based, are opposed to this. They do not want to be embroiled in a conflictual U.S.-Russian relationship. I think that's fundamental. Finally, Congress, in its wisdom, has cut funding for some of this, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff don't want any part of this. They've called missile defense pet rocks because it undermines our real security in pursuit of a fantasy.
Professor Postol, what's the point of this system? What are they trying to accomplish?
Well, I think your earlier speakers, in my view, have correctly described the issues that need to be addressed politically. The problem that adds even more complexity to this issue is the completely unrealistic character of the technical system that the administration claims will do missile defense. In fact, my earlier statement was simply was caveated in a very important way. I said, if the system components work as the Missile Defense Agency claims they would, in fact, these missile defense components will never work the way the Missile Defense Agency claims they would. But in fact, the United States claims they would work, and the Russians at some level have taken us at our word. So we've got the worst of both worlds. We've got a system that the Russians treat or perceive or treat politically as if it has some capability, which means this raises big political questions of the kind that have been addressed by your other commentators. And at the same time, we have a system that really will provide no realistic defensive capability.
Katrina
Van Hoorn. I think Putin is clever. I mean, he's sort of what he's trying to do with his gambit about Azerbaijan. And now the other day he raised the question of citing missile defense technology in southern Russia is to delay. I think that's what's happening here. I think, Amy, there's another point here. Some of the fear about bringing this technology into the Czech Republic and Poland would not be as fierce if there wasn't a sense of a solemn promise broken about NATO expansion. What's ironic is that this summit at Kennebunkport, the first foreign leader invited to the Bush family compound, suggests that the role Papa Bush is playing in this, because Papa Bush, one, ended the Cold War officially in 1989 at the Malta summit, a more productive summit with Gorbachev, and two, made a solemn promise to Russia that NATO would not expand eastward. So I think you have in this administration, you see the Cheney wing, you see sort of the Bush wing, and now you see the reassertion of Papa Bush and a little bit of the Reagan crowd, because Papa Bush doesn't want to lose the legacy of having ended the Cold War. But the real anger is that these missile technologies are encroaching further and further eastward into what were Warsaw Pact countries. And you ask at the end of the Cold War, why is a military alliance moving eastward? These are fundamental questions that are at the heart of this conflictual relationship.
Professor Postol, you're a professor at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. You've been very critical of your own university for its role in the development of so-called missile defense. It's gotten something like $70 million to do this. Can you explain what's happening at MIT and your thoughts on it?
The problem at MIT is, I think, the institution is too closely tied to a laboratory they operate that has well over $600 million a year in revenues that MIT is in one way or another benefiting from. And the MIT Lincoln Laboratory, which is this separate institution, was involved in concealing the failure of a very critical missile defense experiment, which was supposed to show whether or not the current system could tell the difference between a basketball-sized balloon and warheads. And the system was unable to do this. So this basically means that in no realistic combat situation that is imaginable, the system has no chance of working. The MIT Corporation, including its board of directors, known as the Executive Committee, have been involved, in my opinion, have been involved in concealing this from the Congress and the American people. And I've been pursuing this matter, and I think the Congress will almost certainly be picking up on this.
I also wanted to ask you about your debunking of, in 1991, after the Gulf War, what was considered the star at the time, the Patriot missiles, and how successful they were dealing with taking out the Scuds. You came to a very different conclusion that so outraged Raytheon that made the Patriot missile and the Pentagon that they classified your findings, your studying of the videotape. Explain what you found.
Well, first of all, classifying the public information is not consistent with a democratic process, and I did not acquiesce to their claims. But what my colleagues and I found is that the Patriot was essentially a total failure in the Gulf War of 1991. This is now widely accepted as truth. When we first raised the question, the U.S. Army had told the Congress that the Patriot was 96% effective in the Gulf War of 1991. We found that it almost certainly failed to intercept a single Scud warhead in the entire war. So this was an important result, not so much because of its implications for the war of 1991, since very little was done in terms of military consequence from the incoming Scuds, but it was very important in the political debate that followed, where people were trying to make this falsely represented success into an argument for complete and comprehensive missile defense that would be global. And so there are two levels to this, like in many situations. There's a political level and a technical level. And I've been focusing on the technical level because I think you have very competent people on this panel who can speak to the political level. So I'm just trying to add reality to the discussion in terms of the technical possibilities.
And what has Putin proposed, Professor Postol?
Well, what Putin proposed, and I think it's a fluid proposal, so the details are not exactly important. He proposed to make a large early warning radar that is currently operating in Azerbaijan and looks out over Iran available to the United States for monitoring Iranian missile tests. Now, this radar is not an ideal radar for monitoring missile defense tests, but it actually would do a pretty good job in assisting a missile defense of the kind that the United States has proposed for Europe in acquiring attacking warheads so that they could be engaged. I'm not arguing this is a good idea. I'm just simply explaining that this radar could play a very useful, practical role. So I was in Washington last week, and all of the people are repeating these arguments that sound plausible but have no basis, that somehow this radar is inappropriate. It's a fine radar for that purpose.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, could this escalate an arms race with Iran concerned about this on the border?
Well, it's very possible. I mean, I think that's why Russia is so keen. And again, there was no agreement, I think, between Bush and Putin on Iran and the question of more sanctions. Russia is at the crossroads between sort of the West and Islamic civilization and Iran, and it is very eager to avoid a heightening of sanctions and a heightening of tension because they believe that there is the possibility of a grand bargain and that sanctions will abet hardliners inside Iran.
Finally, the protests against the war in Iraq that were taking place nearby Kennebunkport, the estate where the Bushes and Putin were meeting, and also Russia's role in Chechnya.
Yeah. This is one of the most brutal civil wars that still goes underreported, partly because of Russia's clampdown on an independent press. Anna Politkovskaya, the journalist who was assassinated last year, partly because of her reporting on Chechnya, was one of the few who could report. I think that Putin dangerously often tries to link it to the fight against international terrorism, when in fact it really is a civil war. Related to that, Amy, the status of independent journalists is still grim. Interestingly, Bush did not bring up the status of democracy on a day in which he commuted the sentence of Scooter Libby, when we learn more about torture by the United States and secret sites in the new Europe. No wonder that Bush didn't want to bring attention to that. But the best news is that inside Russia, journalists are working together in solidarity. Last month, in the Siberian city of Tomsk, one TV station issued a protest letter in defense of the independent media. 2,000 or more journalists have already signed on. So you're beginning to see protest inside, which in my view is always the most effective, Russian journalists defending their own rights.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, thanks so much for joining us. Editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, longtime analyst on U.S.-Russian relations, Theodore Postol, professor of science, technology, and national security policy at MIT. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, two high school students will join us. They handed President Bush a letter to tell him to stop torturing prisoners. We'll hear their story. Stay with us.
When the people lead, the leaders they will have to follow. And all their lies and their alibis they will have to swallow.
Harper, the people lead. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. For years, the Bush administration has come under heavy criticism from human rights groups, legal scholars, members of Congress for its detention policies and support for torture in the so-called War on Terror. But last week, President Bush got a rebuke from an unexpected source. Last Monday, the president was meeting with this year's presidential scholars. They're high school students. One of them handed him a letter signed by 50 of the students. It read, quote, "As members of the Presidential Scholars Class of 2007, we've been told we represent the best and brightest of our nation. Therefore, we believe we have responsibility to voice our convictions. We do not want America to represent torture. We urge you to do all in your power to stop violations of the human rights of detainees, to cease illegal renditions, and to apply the Geneva Convention to all detainees, including those designated enemy combatants." That's what the letter said. The White House said President Bush had not expected the letter, but read it, then told the students the United States is not torture and that the country values human rights. The seniors had been invited to the East Room as members of the Presidential Scholars Program, one of the nation's highest honors for graduating high school students. Two of the presidential scholars who signed the letter to President Bush join us today in our Firehouse studio. Leah Anthony Labresco is a graduate of the Wheatley School in Mineola, New York, and Mari Oy graduated from Wellesley High School in Massachusetts. She personally handed Bush the letter last week. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Thank
Explain
you.
The scene, Mari.
Well, it actually took place outside on the White House lawn. We were facing the Thomas Jefferson Memorial, so that seemed like a good omen in some way. And we're all lined up. It was 95 degrees outside. The president walked in and said that, gave us a short speech saying that as we went on into our careers, it was important to treat others as we would like to be treated. And he told us that we would have to make choices we'd be able to live with for the rest of our lives. I had the letter in my hand and Leah had another copy. And so I said to the president, several of us made a choice and we would like you to have this, and handed him the letter. He put it in his pocket and said, I'll have it. And they took the photo. After that, he took it out and said, should I read it now or should I wait? And I said, it's up to you, Mr. President. And he did read the letter to himself right there. And then we were able to talk about it very briefly.
And what did he say? How did he respond?
He read down the letter. He got to the part about torture. He looked up and he said, America doesn't torture people. And I said, if you look specifically at what the points we made, because we were careful to outline specific things that are wrong with the administration's policy. So I said, you know, if you look specifically at what we said, we ask you to cease illegal renditions. And then I said, you know, please remove your signing statement to the McCain anti-torture bill. And then I said that for me personally, the issue of detainee rights also had a lot of importance because my grandparents had been interned during World War II for being Japanese American. At that point, he just said America doesn't torture people again. And another kid actually from Montana came forward and said, please make the U.S. a leader in human rights. And that happened in the space of about a minute, but it was a very interesting minute with the President of the United States.
Leah, you had the other letter in case Mary wasn't able to do what she did. How did you plan this?
Well, what happened was, I know I came down thinking, if I'm going to be in the room with the president, I've got to say something because silence betokens consent and there's a lot going on I don't want to consent to. What was really remarkable is that when I came down for the program, I met people like Mari. Everyone wanted to, a lot of the people wanted to say something to the president. People just kept saying, yes, you know, we have to do something, we're here. So when we started talking about the issues we wanted to address, the issue that really came out was torture, because it's not a partisan issue, the issue of human rights, that we thought it was something everyone could get behind. And in a way, it's really a microcosm of some of the problems there have been in this administration, because we see here the secrecy that's been going on with the way they've been hiding secret CIA prisons, the renditions to other countries, and also the disregard for the humanity of people we call our enemies that sort of has been the guiding principle in everything that's been going wrong. So the more we talked about it, we wanted to write something, we wanted to say something. So we wrote a letter, and we finished it about 2 in the morning, yeah, the day before we met the
how
president.
How many of you wrote it?
I think around 6 or so.
And how many are in the Presidential Scholars Program?
141.
Right, there were 136 people there, but our whole planning process took place over the course of 12 hours before we met the president, some of which we were asleep for. But I guess it was sort of something we thought about for a long time before we went down to Washington independently and privately. But, you know, not even everyone there knew there was a letter. We went around, we'd had it on the bus, we'd had it at breakfast that day, and we sort of approached people individually. And some people looked at it and it said, you know, they hadn't been planning on doing something, but they looked at it and they said, this is respectful, this is accurate, I can sign this, and they signed it. So I think it was important. The manner in which it was done was also important.
So more than a third of the students signed.
I was really blown away. I was thinking, you know, if we get a tenth or so, that's good. That sends a statement. Then I check with Mari at lunch. I'm like, so how are we doing? She goes, well, we're 2 signatures shy of 50. I'm like, wow.
Mari, your mother also was a presidential scholar?
Yes, in 1968 when LBJ was president. And she felt at the time that she wanted to say something about the Vietnam War. But she had an English teacher back at the school she came from who she didn't want to offend. And the English teacher had stressed that it was important, you know, to stay quiet when you were in the presence of a president. And I've had teachers that have stressed the opposite throughout my high school career. And so I thought of them, and I thought of my mother, and I thought of what I would be comfortable with in 40 years. And I think we did the right thing while we were there.
What did your mother say?
Well, when she found out, she'd been touring Washington. Our parents weren't with us at the time we went to the White House. And she was actually in the Holocaust Museum in the last room when I called her to say that we'd given the letter. She didn't know there was a letter beforehand when I called her to tell her what had happened. And she said that she walked out into the bright sunlight with tears streaming down her face. But since a lot of people walk out of the Holocaust Museum that way, you know, no one noticed anything out of the ordinary.
Your grandfather was a poet in the detention camps?
Right. He was born in California, but he'd grown up in Japan, and he spent some of his time in camp writing senryu, a type of Japanese poetry. It was sort of something to do, obviously, and it sort of brought him some solace when he was there.
Do you have any of his poems?
I do. They published a short book of them, and I sent some over, too. Hmm. So.
Leah, just before you went on the air, you were telling me your name, Leah Anthony Librescu.
Anthony's for Susan B. Anthony. My parents are both historians and feminists, so I actually am named after the great women's rights leader, and I have my mom's last name instead of my dad's.
You head to China in a week?
Yes, I'm really excited. It was an opportunity for some of the presidential scholars. And I just can't wait. I mean, the world's shrinking every day with the internet, but it's so exciting to get to see things for myself and learn more.
And Mari, in October, we interviewed Sarah Chase, the former NPR correspondent who covered the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, leaving journalism in 2002 to run an aid organization in Kandahar called Afghans for Civil Society. She now runs a collective called Argan that sells soap and handcrafted products made in Afghanistan that I know you're involved with now. This is Sarah Chase, what she had to say about the collective.
It's a way of trying to combat opium growing. In other words, the best way to make it possible for people not to plant poppy is for them to be able to make money growing other things.
And your choice to do this?
It's about grassroots. It's about building democracy on whatever level you can, and a cooperative where there are good relations with producers, where there's a collective decision-making process, and where we can honor a lot of the traditional licit crops that Kandahar has been known for millennia, seems like a worthwhile thing to be involved in.
That's Sarah Chase. Marioi, how are you involved?
For a lot of the time that project was getting going, all of the soap came through my basement. We had a group at my high school.
The soap came through your basement?
Oh, yeah. The boxes would show up. They were shipped from Kandahar. And we would go down and pick them up, open them up, find this like sort of jewel-like soap packed in odd Afghan newspapers with things written on them we couldn't read, and then work on the packaging. We did marketing. I think that sort of helped me coming into this because I had the experience working with other people and sort of getting everyone together, even if we hadn't known each other ahead of time. And of course, it's also been amazing working with Sarah. I knew her family a little bit before the project started up, but I talked to her and I said, if there's anything that I can do to help this project, you tell me. And there turned out to be more I could do than I expected. So it was a wonderful thing to work on during high school.
Where do you head to college?
I'm going to Yale next year.
And
Yale.
Leah as well. And what are both your plans in college? What are you going to study?
Well, actually, one thing I'm really excited about, specifically at Yale, I don't know what I'm going to major in, but Yale has the only microfinance program of all the colleges in the U.S., I believe. The same kinds of ideas that motivate the Grameen Bank they're putting to work in New Haven. And it's something I'd sure like to get involved in.
And Mari?
I'm undecided officially, but I'm interested in English and international relations.
And what do you think this meeting with the president will mean for you in your life?
I don't know. I hope it means something to him. I don't know whether it will or not, but I hope he'll in some way think about what we said to him. For me, I don't think I've changed beforehand or afterward, but it's definitely something I will think back on and remember about as vividly as anything in my life so far.
I've got to say for me that the most remarkable moment wasn't meeting the president and handing over the letter. It was everything that had gone before that, the talking about it, the realizing that across the country there are all these people who are so invested in what's going on and really are committed to making a difference, and that once you give people data, they're likely to stand up and join you.
I want to thank you both for being with us, Leah Anthony Libresco and Marioi, both presidential scholars who gave the president a letter that said that the U.S. government should not be involved in torturing people. That does it for today's broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Hoto Kadus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Presser, Matei, Anjali Kamat, Jay Babalota, Jeffrey Hagerman, and Nicole Salazar. I want to welcome little Estrella Dixon Carrion into the world, the new little daughter of our former producer, Maria Carrion, who is now in Spain with her family. Congratulations to Maria and Kwame, and to Gabriela as well. That does it for our broadcast. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. Special thanks to Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Andrew Quinn, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.